You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Most crime novelists have to use their imaginations to describe how, or even imagine how, what a criminal behaves like. But Martin Clark has been observing them firsthand as a circuit court judge in a small Virginia town since 1995. And this double life might help explain the specificity and wealth of convincing detail he's been able to put into his three novels. His latest, The Legal Limit, is published by Knopf, and I'm very pleased it has brought Martin Clark back to the show today. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me back. My third trip, so I'm grateful.
As you keep on writing interesting books, we'll keep on inviting you back. In your introduction, you write that you never planned to write a novel based on your work, but isn't this novel based on a real case that came to your attention as a judge in Stuart, Virginia?
It's based on That's a good answer, and that's very compelling. The book's fiction, and I want to be very clear about that. I don't want to wind up on a couch somewhere with an angry finger being wagged in my face suggesting that I've misled folks. So let me say two or three times, it's fiction, but it's grounded in fact, and it's grounded in a case that I actually had some involvement with, and because of, I suppose, ethical reasons, I'm not very much inclined to tell you what that case is, but also I think it makes a lot more fun for people to try to figure out precisely the case that's at the root of the book.
Well, in the movies, they usually start off by saying, based on a true story, whatever that means, and then you watch this movie and think, well, it can't be based that closely on the true story. In this case, what makes it so convincing is that you know so much about how the law works.
Yeah, well, and backing up just a little bit, one of the things, I hope people don't think that it is didactic or that it is sort of a procedural or that it's a textbook. When I write a book, the thing that I'm going to do most of all is entertain people. I like books, and my two prior books are in this vein. I like books that have big plot. I like slam-bang writing, I call it. I don't like elliptical, hard-to-access stuff. So, I appreciate you're saying that it has a real feel to it and that it's connected to what I'm writing about. But by the same token, I hope that folks will understand that it's entertainment, most of all.
And there's a strong psychological strain through the thing. It's about two brothers who are quite different and have a complicated life and a complicated past. Some people have even described it as having a biblical feel to it.
The odd thing is someone asked me that yesterday, and as I was writing it, it was very micro for me when I wrote about their struggle and their interaction, and I never thought of it in sort of epic terms or biblical terms, and now that some reviews are out, I see Cain and Abel again and again, and I don't know if it's quite that grand or not, but certainly it brothers, especially feuding brothers, That's fertile ground if you're a writer.
A feuding brothers with a very complicated past because there was an abusive father.
Yes.
And the older brother protected the younger brother from the father and feels that he is owed.
And that's a nice sort of send up or lead up to the first pivotal point of the book. And you know, when I write books, I like to write books that have a sort of a beginning, a middle, and an end. And as you go through, I would like for there to be sort of payoffs, little revelations. So much I think writing today becomes, I like the word precious, but it's obscure, it's hard to access, it's very introverted. And so I like to write books that have payoffs. And that's the sort of lead up to the first payoff when there is a murder. And one brother decides not so much to cover up in the traditional sense, but to help his brother avoid detection and avoid prosecution.
Well, the younger brother is a lawyer.
Becomes a lawyer, yes.
And the older brother has lived a troubled life. So you're dealing with issues of family loyalty and personal morality and also the demands of the law.
It's always an interesting question, and maybe I'll ask you. I mean, what would you do? I mean, what would Trump in your world, would you... if you truly thought that you had a relative, a son, a daughter, who was innocent, factually innocent, but was about to be convicted of a crime he or she didn't commit, would you get on the stand and lie? Would you raise your right hand and lie? I think most people would. And in my part of the world, there's almost an exemption. You can lie for your family, and juries and judges probably are not too unsettled by it. But it's always a tension, you know, what trumps the code of Virginia or blood and family loyalty.
So when you're deciding a case, mitigating circumstances are one of the factors that help you decide. In the first section of your book, you write, this story should also give folks a taste of how it feels to make hard decisions, stick them in a lonely black robe, and situate them so they can understand how the correct answer, the right ruling, sometimes brings along its own tricks and complications.
Yeah. And that's what I've tried to do in the book. As I said, I like to entertain folks. But if I've structured this book correctly, what will happen is you get about 300 pages in, you'll come to a crossroads. And at that crossroads, you will be transported, I hope, into the novel, and you, like a judge or a juror, will be faced with a decision. I like to say that any writer can take you to the county fair and describe the tilt-a-whirl. What I want to do is put you on the tilt-a-whirl. And the tension that I try to set up in the book, and it's a tension that we see frequently in court, and I shouldn't say frequently, but we see it enough that it's vexing. And that's the tension, what I call the ugly sulk between law and justice. Do you break the law? Do you massage the law? Do you whittle away at the law to accomplish what we would call rough or fair justice?
And sometimes, we do argue that our criminal justice system is really about the law, or is it about justice, or is it about avoiding injustice?
Well, it's so much embedded in popular discourse now, this notion. It people don't even give it a second look or thought. This notion, quote, we want judges who will simply follow the law. And I agree that's a cornerstone of our society, of our judicial system.
And that's why we have mandatory sentencing.
One of my favorite takeoff points, and one of my I have real problems with that. But if you think about that and you look at it in terms of a chronology, if judges just followed the law, if that's all we did, number one, you wouldn't need judges. And number two, probably most African Americans in this country would not be able to vote, or at least there would be significant impediments in terms of their right to vote, only because the U.S. Supreme Court did not follow the law. Was their franchise protected or restored? If you think about it in terms of a chronology or a history, in 1965, before Griswold versus Connecticut, there was no right to privacy. The police could theoretically search your bedroom for contraceptives. Judges did not follow the law. If you think about it, perhaps at the other end of the philosophical spectrum, recently, in a special interest to folks in Southside Virginia and, I suppose, in New York, there was no fundamental Second Amendment right to have a firearm. Judges, again, did not follow the law. So when people say that I just want judges who follow the law and they're a rubber stamp and just hand out mandatory minimums, I think that's problematic, and I hope folks will give that some thought.
My guest is Martin Clark, who's written a book called The Legal Limit. This is his third novel and the one with the least colorful title of the three. We'll get to that in just a moment. The book is published by Knopf. Is it different where you are than in other places? For example, you're in Southern Virginia.
South Side, we call it.
Well, the South Side of Virginia strikes me as being very different than Northern Virginia, the part that's close to Washington, D.C. Would a judge act differently and decide differently? You're also in a town where the population rarely exceeds 1,000.
That's correct. It's odd that you would ask that. I was in Washington last night, and at my reading, some of my friends who are judges in Northern Virginia, they were there, and we had a discussion about the book. And I think it's one of the interesting things about the book. When you read the book, folks are going to have different perspectives on how the judge should have reacted in the book, what the prosecutor should have done, and how everything should play out. And one of my fellow judges from Arlington said, the way the judge in this book proceeded and solved the case is clearly not the way I would have done things. It's wrong, it's a slippery slope, and you can't do it. So I think there's, it's interesting, if you had 100 judges read this, I think you would probably have at least 50 or 100 different views.
I can only imagine what Antonin Scalia would think about the way the judge acts here. would some residents of Stuart, Virginia recognize themselves in your novels?
Well, that wouldn't be hard because they are there by name. I love my small hometown, and it's almost a character in the book. It's sort of a vanishing kind of place where merchants still seal deals with a handshake and men tip their hats on the street. It's a very unique corner of the world, but it's quickly being eroded by any number of variables. So you would recognize the setting, you would recognize the small community, and a lot of folks are mentioned by name. And no one, I might add, in a very negative vein. I like all the folks I write about.
You have said in interviews that the title of this novel is not quite as colorful as the titles you picked for the first two, the many aspects of mobile home living and also plain heathen mischief. But the three words, the legal limit, leave a lot of room for interpretation, and that's why you like them.
I like that. I like the title a lot. Originally, the title of this book was .08, and it was very interesting because when I came here to discuss the book with everyone at Knopf, very few people picked up the reference, and it's sort of a litmus test.
But that's the alcoholic limit.
It says a lot about you, doesn't it? I mean, you know.
Yeah. Well, I've never exceeded that.
I haven't either. And I was joking. I said, if you live in Manhattan and you just, if you're in cabs and limos, you don't really have to worry about whether you can have one more beer at the roadhouse and then stagger home or drive home in the back roads. But the title was originally .08, and it seemed a bit confusing for folks. And I thought about it for a while and chose the legal limit, which works on a number of levels, the limitations of the law. There's actually a DUI case in the book that plays a real role in driving the plot.
And we've been talking about what judges do, but you deal also with what lawyers do. In the novel, when Mason is in law school, he attends a seminar with Jim Bulldog Young, one of the best trial lawyers in Virginia. You describe him as a charming, robust man whose genuine decency never failed to influence a jury and whose capacity to take a witness apart and not seem like a showboat had served him well for 30 years of practice. And when he's asked by one of the students what the most important aspect of trying a murder case is, Young says, "Only thing that matters in a murder case is did the fellow who's dead need to be killed, and did the right son of a bitch do the job?"
True. That's absolutely true. It's funny.
Is that something somebody actually said to you, or did you come up with that?
My father actually said that to me. And one of the, my father's a lawyer, and he actually said that to me. Interestingly enough, though, and I think it was the Los Angeles Times review of the book, the reviewer evidently had a legal background, and he said, "I have heard those sentiments expressed throughout the country and throughout the courtrooms from the Bronx to the West Coast." And it's really true. We spend a lot of time as judges and lawyers with jury instructions, a lot of smoke and mirrors, and they're important. I mean, you have to have parameters to decide a case. But ultimately, it's a very fact-driven, visceral decision that juries make, or so I think.
I was surprised by the wide range of crimes in this book. I would have thought that in a little town in the south side of Virginia, you know, that the worst problem would be a couple of DUIs, once in a while a crime of passion, but drug trafficking and all the other stuff you have here.
We do. Southside Virginia is racked by methamphetamine. We run probably a year or two cyclically behind everyone else. If it was a problem in an urban area 2 or 3 years ago, it filters down to us a little bit later. But I think we're just a microcosm of the rest of the world. We have the same problems that everybody else has.
Just one other thing. You included a first-person introduction and afterward that falls completely outside the novel. Why did you feel the necessity to do that?
The book has a part one, which is my voice, and you just read some of that. Then there's the novel proper, and then there's an afterward or a part three. I mentioned earlier I like to have sort of double barrel. I like big endings and payoffs, and I like to think that the afterword gives you sort of a double barrel or double barreled ending. That it's a little coda that will tell you just a little bit more and perhaps give you one more twist. So that's why it's added.
Martin Clark's latest novel, with great reviews, just as the two previous ones got great reviews. This one is called The Legal Limit. It is published by Knopf. And I want to thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me back. Always a pleasure. Maybe we'll see you again in 4 years.